From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
To date, Illinois has had relative success in keeping this virus at bay, and we're still doing better than many of our neighbors, but we can't let up, and these numbers are indicating a concerning direction. I have one simple thing to say to everyone in areas with rising positivity: mask up. It will make a tremendous difference in keeping infections down.
It's Governor J.B. Pritzker giving the same advice that he has for months about slowing the spread of the coronavirus. But Illinois faces a critical point as cases and the positivity rate are on the rise. We'll discuss that and more coming up on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. Also joining us is Charlie Wheeler, emeritus professor and former State House journalist. And Charlie's also a longtime State House and a government observer. Also with us, Hannah Meisel, who's covering state government and politics for NPR Illinois. And our guest this week is Mark Maxwell. He's the Capitol Bureau Chief for WCIA-TV. Mark, glad to have you with us once again.
Sean, good to be here. Thanks.
Charlie, I'm going to go to you first, though. We've been talking about COVID-19 since the pandemic began. This week, we've seen the highest one-day total of cases. As I mentioned, the positivity rate is rising, but there have been warnings for a long time that this would happen in the fall. That prophecy seems to be coming true.
Yes, unfortunately. The state actually on Thursday reported a record of 4,015 new cases, which is the largest single-day record ever. And they also reported 53 more people have died from the disease, which is the highest total in 2 months going back to July. The infection rate is now up to 4.9%. So all the indications are going in the wrong direction. And the public health officials say it's because a large segment of the population doesn't pay attention to the guidelines, doesn't observe the wearing a mask, doesn't keep social distancing, doesn't wash their hands, gathers in large groups. And a lot of it seems to be spreading from families, where one person will be out and do something, contract the virus, come back, and then give it to everybody else in the family unit. So it's really a very scary situation, because all the indicators are going in the wrong direction, and we're heading into fall and then winter, when obviously it's going to be a lot more harder to be dining outdoors, and there's going to be the inclination, people wanting to be inside, and you know, it's kind of scary.
Yeah, Mark, the big question I think on people's minds might be whether or not we're headed to another stay-at-home order like we saw earlier in the year. Is it too soon to be thinking about that?
It's never too soon, and those of us who look at these numbers daily and look at the trend lines, not only of the infection rate or the percentage of people who test positive, but also the number of people presenting to the hospital, which is one of the more alarming figures that you can watch in this, that's growing. One way that this stood out to me this week was in a series of emails back and forth with a high-level staffer at the Department of Public Health, and they got tied up in some meetings. I think they reached out to me at 10:30, maybe even close to 11 o'clock one night, and said, "Hey, sorry, couldn't quite get back to you. Sorry for the late hour," but they were working all day. And for many of us, there has been that break from after, you know, July, August. It seemed like the coronavirus, yes, while it was still here, those big numbers we saw back in April and May had largely subsided and stayed steady. But now those are turning back up again. And there are a number of people who are looking at the colder weather, looking at staying indoors more often. And I think rightly wondering, how do we handle that? And how do we brace for the potential of a second surge should it, you know, God forbid, get that high again?
Hannah, you've been following this as well since the pandemic began, posting numbers online every day, providing that service for people. So you're definitely qualified to give your view on what we've seen here in just this past week.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers have been kind of staggering. I think everyone, there's COVID fatigue, right? I mean, we've been doing this since mid-March. We are now over 7 months in. And, you know, we had that break in the summer. Things went back to semi-normal. You know, you could see your friends outside, you could dine in. The state regulations also, you know, technically you could have a gathering of up to 50 people and that would be A-okay. But, you know, as fall sets in and we're also facing flu season, kids have gone back to school in person in, you know, many areas of the state. And even the schools that have started out online, they're looking to go back to a hybrid model starting in the next few weeks. It's a very uncertain time. And these new numbers, they're not good. And if the governor, if the Department of Public Health had to come back out and say, you know what, these numbers aren't good, instead of focusing on the regions that we've seen resurgences in, we can't do that. We have to take a whole state approach. People are going to be very, very upset just because of that fatigue, just because businesses were starting to see a little sliver of light in their summer and early fall profits, getting, you know, obviously nowhere near back to normal, but, you know, they could maybe float themselves. But it's going to be very devastating, both emotionally and for the economy, if we have to go back into another lockdown. But the way the numbers are heading, I wouldn't be surprised if in the next few weeks we get some very upsetting news about that.
Yeah, Mark, we
and for a while the notion was, oh, it's a big city problem, it's the city of Chicago, and the most recent death report put out by the Department of Public Health totally disavows that notion. There were 53 additional confirmed deaths, and this is as of, I guess it would have been Thursday. And if you break them down by region, there were 11 in Cook County, 10 in the collar counties, but 14 in Southern Illinois. And so that suggests that it's not just an urban problem. And it's becoming clear that the downstate areas aren't maybe taking this as seriously as they are in Chicago. And of course, we have to remember the cases is sort of a predictor of what the deaths will be in a couple weeks. So if the cases are coming up or are rising, then the likelihood of increased mortality being reported in a couple weeks also rises.
Yeah, Mark, what Charlie mentioned there about certain areas not taking it as seriously as others, you cover mostly central Illinois, but some of southern Illinois as well. And have you seen that to be the case? Is there a difference of opinion on whether or not you know, everybody feels the same way of whether this virus is as real as it seems to be?
Well, certainly early on, there was a pushback from, and some of it was political, right? But there were also people who just lived farther apart in more sparsely populated regions that just didn't see, you know, maybe they saw it on the news or on social media. They saw stories about the coronavirus happening, and we're talking about back in March and April and maybe in May, right? But they just didn't see it in their neighborhood as often. And it really truly wasn't there at the time. So there was a time not long ago when most of the coronavirus infections were in the larger population centers in an area. But it's certainly true now that the virus has spread far enough and wide enough that you can be in the least populated or most populated county of the state interacting with someone and be at risk, which is why you see people like, you know, Chris Christie at the White House, who said, look, I should have worn a mask when I was indoors. And he made an interesting comment. He said just this week, it doesn't really cost you a lot. There's not really a downside to wearing a mask, and there's a big upside. It might actually help you. So we're seeing sort of the public thinking, even in the political sphere, where everything seems divisive these days, the public thinking on just wearing a mask and keeping your distance and all those things is coming around. It's only taken about 7 or 8 months, but we're getting there.
Well, I know, Hannah, that the governor and Department of Public Health and the Illinois High School Association all have a big decision on their hands coming up here, and that is winter sports like basketball. Those things are getting ready to launch here soon if they're allowed to do so. And there's been even some talk about having, say, basketball played with the players having to wear masks. But these types of issues, are getting real now for the state as far as having to decide these types of factors. Have we heard anything more when it comes to sports and where high school sports is headed at this point?
The governor made some comments when asked this week about specifically basketball and winter sports, but, you know, obviously would not commit to anything. But he made a comment like, you know, we would like to see more rather than less. We would like to see our kids play. I mean, high school sports is a really emotional thing for parents, for, the kids playing. Sometimes there is actual, futures at stake if you are gunning for some sort of scholarship, especially if you're a senior. I mean, I remember my high school activities, very nerdy. I was in a very competitive marching band, but it was my whole life. And I would have been devastated. There was, one event that was canceled because of like a massive flood. And we were all just so sad because of that. This is obviously 1,000 times worse. Earlier, we remember back a month, 6 weeks ago, folks sued the state to the, in the Illinois High School Association over not being allowed to play football in the spring sports, the fall sports, which I should say, I feel like what gets lost in that conversation was that IHSA put out, guidelines that actually football would be played in the spring this year if we're able to. But those lawsuits, for the most part, failed or stalled. And so, I would imagine anyone who tries to take the same legal tact for winter sports, if there's a sudden turn and those things can't be played, they'll probably face the same fate. So, if people want to play, then you're going to have to wear masks or follow, maybe parents can't be in the stands, or if they are, they're going to have to take extreme precautions. But, I think the governor he faced a lot of rage and pushback from certain very vocal groups. And I don't think he wants another fight like Kansas, especially as the numbers get worse.
Yeah, Charlie, I mean, whether it's sports or whether it's kids back in school or just a variety of other issues coming up here, these are going to be some tough decisions for the governor and Department of Public Health to make, because there are going to be people upset no matter which way you come down on them.
Yeah, and it's kind of a, as you say, it's difficult decisions, and it's almost a no-win situation, because whatever you decide, people are going to be unhappy. And Hannah made a very good point. For some high school athletes, their maybe best and only hope of actually being able to get a college education, be able to afford it, is for them to get a scholarship. And a lot of it in normal times would be based on, how does the kid look on the football field this fall as a senior? How's he do on the basketball court? How does she do playing volleyball? And with those winter sports postponed until spring, football and volleyball, the recruiting season is going to be pretty much over by the time those kids actually get out to play. And same thing if basketball gets delayed. But on the other hand, you look at, what do we need to do to be able to win this battle? And I look at it as, literally, I look at it as a war. We're at war with this virus. It's not some other country sending its troops, its tanks, and its planes to fight with us, but it is just as deadly. And the national toll has already exceeded the number of U.S. citizens or U.S. soldiers lost in a number of wars. And so we have to look at it that way. And if it has to disrupt our life, sure. Now, none of you guys are old enough to have been around at the time of World War II. I was, for better or for worse. And I can recall some of the things that, the sacrifices that my family had to make when I was just a little kid. And my grandparents and my great aunts and uncles would take the ration coupons they got to buy shoes, and they'd all give them to my parents so that their little baby boy would be able to have shoes to fit his growing feet. Now, that's just one tiny example of what the mindset was, you know, 70 years ago. And I think we've got to look at it that way. And it's, oh, I'm really inconvenienced because, darn, I wanted to go to the store today and shop. And if I do, I have to wear a mask. What a pain. We have to be willing to make those sacrifices. And it is hard on high school athletes. But again, if you look at somebody like Ted Williams, who's maybe one of the best baseball players ever, he lost significant portions of his career because he was in the service during the wars. So that's a septuagenarian's take on things.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and our guest this week is Mark Maxwell. He's with WCIA-TV. Well, the state budget has cratered because of the pandemic this year, but one area of the economy seems to be holding up pretty well, and that's legalized marijuana. This past week, we learned that the state has showing now over $100 million in tax revenue has been collected in the first 8 months since recreational marijuana became legal in the state. And Mark, getting away from those numbers specifically, this was something a lot of people felt needed to happen for a lot of different reasons, but there was certainly a budget impact that they were hoping for, and they've certainly got it so far.
It certainly seems so, and there was some question because when so many other businesses, especially retail businesses, were throttled down and had to close, and we saw places lose 80% of their revenue. Well, when you're stuck at home with very few other places to go, what are you going to do? It turns out the people of Illinois have purchased almost 1.4 million cannabis items from retail shops around the state and these new marijuana shops that have set up. And the people that buy these products will tell you the tax is a lot. It's pretty high in Illinois. And that has been funneling into the state's revenue coffers, even while those other typical tax revenue streams have dried up. So it certainly has been something. It's hard to really decipher how much of that is because of the exciting new product, how much of it is because people are truly stuck at home and, you know, looking for extra recreation. But it certainly seems that the industry itself is off to a strong start, and the state coffers are capturing what they can. And this is, it's still early, right? Because the governor's office has said that they still intend to hand out many more licenses for many new shops. So we haven't even seen the real reopening of this industry, the second wave, if you will, of marijuana business that could still come and plant its roots in Illinois.
Hannah, just how far along are we with the with this industry? As Mark mentioned, there's a lot more dispensary licenses that are going to be handed out. Are we, you know, halfway there? Are we, you know, where are we at this point?
I mean, we really are at the beginning. In order to stand up the industry beginning January 1st of this year, the companies, the dispensaries who had already been selling medical marijuana in the last 5 years, they got first dibs at those recreational licenses. And then we had this year intended on awarding 75 licenses for dispensaries, and then awarding more licenses for things like growing, infusion, and transport. And those were intended for those social equity applicants, those who come from a background of, you know, being disproportionately affected in the war on drugs. But of course, you know, we've run into a lot of snags there, and there is now lawsuits, both from those who lost out on this lottery that's going to take place, I mean, any week now, I think, to ultimately award those 75, and the folks who actually initially won entry into that lottery, saying that the governor's fix that he announced, what, like 3 weeks ago, that more people would be allowed to go into their application and say, actually, I think I should have been awarded more You know, we've seen that this outside firm, KPMG, who graded the applications, kind of graded them unevenly. And we're also seeing more and more a drip about the actual winners. And, you know, it all creates a cloud of confusion. And, you know, folks who have spent, you know, a lot of money, those applications weren't cheap. And I know, you know, some people got their application fees covered, but a lot, you know, put up a lot of personal capital in order to see that dream fulfilled. But, you know, the folks who crafted this law, they said, we had no idea how many people would want to enter, which, I mean, hindsight's always 20/20, but I the farther we get along, the more I'm like, well, that just, it doesn't make sense. Of course, so many people would want to apply and so many people would want to profit off of this industry that, you know, clearly has a lot of room to grow. But anyway, to answer your original question, the state law for recreational cannabis allows 500 dispensaries eventually. So we are several years out from that.
The big controversy about that right now is just what Hannah alluded to. The whole promise of this recreational marijuana program in Illinois was that it would make new inroads for people in poverty or people affected by the war on drugs and say, hey, we'll help you start a business. We'll help you grow jobs. We'll help you get a job. If you had been convicted for selling small amounts of marijuana in the past, we're not only going to legalize it, but we're going to get you a foothold in the industry. That was the promise. And a lot of politicians who voted for that, I think we're picturing this small mom and pop shop opening up in the corner where a drugstore used to be or where, you know, some closed business was. And it was this small business sort of growing out of nowhere. Well, those people, like Hannah alluded to, scrounged together whatever resources they had to afford one application. They went all in. And what they didn't know was that a lot of wealthier interests that had a lot of extra money sitting around stacked the deck with a bunch of other applications. They basically went and bought as many applications as they could. And that's why there were so many wealthier interests that won those early round of applications. So you're seeing a lot of people who feel like this didn't quite shake out, especially in the Black community. There are people who are quite upset right now with the Pritzker administration. They feel like they got the short end of the stick after there were some pretty big promises made. So I think the Pritzker administration pressed pause on this. They said, let's go back and look at it before we award this next round. We want to make sure we're doing this right. But there has been a lot of frustration at the early part. And there's been a few instances of these advisors and consultants who come in and charge pretty top dollar rates to these people who have big hopes and dreams. And they say, hey, we know how this system works. We'll help you fill out your application just right. We'll help you get one of these licenses. And it hasn't always worked out that way.
It's shocking somebody's been able to game the system here in Illinois. But just a couple of minutes left here. Mark, I'm going to go back to you because one of the races that is being watched very closely in Illinois is this 13th congressional district race. We have the Republican incumbent Rodney Davis matching up again for the second time against the Democrat Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. Give us sort of the overview of where this race stands with just a few weeks left.
This is their second face-off, and the candidates are getting to know each other better. In 2018, it was decided by just about 2,000 votes. What we're seeing now is that they're so familiar with each other. The attacks are sharpening. I think the hostilities are becoming even more bitter between the two candidates. You're seeing an ugly race. There's a lot of attack ads. There are some that are positive, talking about the future of healthcare and making sure we protect pre-existing conditions. But those are really only defending against the attacks, at least for Congressman Davis. On the other, the Democratic side, the candidate Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan there is saying that he's voted to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. He did that. That's true. He now sort of has taken a step back and said, well, whatever I vote for in the future, we'll make sure we don't take away pre-existing condition coverage. He's asking voters to trust him there because in the past he has voted to take away the Affordable Care Act, which the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office said, well, it would have had that effect. It would have priced people out of the healthcare they now have. They wouldn't be able to afford it. So it's a sharp race. There are a few other races for Congress that might not be as close. Maybe they will. I'd say the former candidate for governor, Jeannie Ives, who ran a primary campaign in 2018, she's running against Congressman Sean Casten in the 6th district, and a state senator, Jim Oberweis, running against an incumbent rookie Democrat, Congresswoman Lauren Underwood in the 14th. Those races could potentially be close. and a few others around the state that are also getting interest. But yeah, it's about 2 weeks to go here, 2 weeks plus. It's going to be interesting down the stretch.
All right, let's go to our notes from the field. And Hannah, let's start with you.
Yeah, we've seen, obviously, because of the pandemic, an emphasis on mail-in voting and early voting. Well, I think the messaging is working. We are breaking all kinds of records here in Illinois. As of this morning, we tape on Friday mornings. We have seen over 900,000 people vote early, whether that's by mail, going in person to a polling place. The bulk of it is vote by mail, but I think voting early in person is starting to catch up, especially as we get closer to Election Day. More and more early voting locations are opening. And just last Friday, we had seen 500,000, and now we're almost to 1 million. I would bet next Friday, we're going to maybe get closer to 2 million. I mean, and by Election Day, who knows? But definitely that messaging has been working.
Charlie?
Well, and I was one of the people who voted early. I went to the drop box down by the county building here in Springfield and dropped my ballot form in. And so I'm in the 900,000, I guess. But when we're talking about earlier, we were talking about how marijuana is providing an additional revenue boost to the state. Well, Governor J.B. Pritzker and his wife, Mary Kate, released their federal and state tax returns for calendar 19 this week. And they showed that had the Fair Tax Amendment been adopted and had those rates been in place for calendar 19, they would have paid $3.7 million more in state income taxes than the amount that they did pay. And so that's, I guess, another argument why the so-called Fair Tax Amendment should be approved by voters.
All right, and Mark?
My notes from the field come from an actual field, an underground natural gas storage field this week. Our images and video from this farmland in Livingston County shows bubbles of methane, natural gas, coming up in farmland creeks, in fields, killing crops, polluting the water streams there and bubbling into the skies. About 2,200 feet below the Earth's surface there is where all that gas is supposed to stay. It was drilled there, buried there in the early 60s. And documents we've obtained from the Department of Natural Resources and other state places tell us that up to 3 million cubic feet of methane each and every day is escaping that storage field underground, perhaps more, much of it reaching the Earth's surface and into the skies. And we saw the DNR ask the Attorney General to enforce that matter back in 2017. 3 years later, still no real enforcement to speak of. The problem still exists, and there are already some lawmakers and other folks who are really wanting to know why the AG's office and other state agencies haven't done more to rein this in. So we're going to keep looking into that to really try to learn how it all happened and what can be done to stop it.
All right. That's all the time we have for State Week. Thanks to our panel, Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and WCIA-TV's Mark Maxwell. Remember, you can find our podcast through the NPR One app and at nprillinois.org. And also, our production assistance provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.